Thanks for listening to the Revelation Lecture Podcast, an audio service of the Wisconsin Lutheran Seminary Library. For more, please visit www.wls.wells.net. Lecture 7, Part B.
There was a hand up there, though. Somebody else had a question. I don't know if it's a mistake to stop in the middle, because I want to get through 17, 18, and 19 today, and because I'd like to have the whole period next time for chapters 20, 21, and 22, where there is more to say again. Anybody have any more questions on this? Well, now we come to the sixth vision, the sixth part of the book, a new vision, the vision of Babylon and the destruction of Babylon. First of all, in chapter 17, now here you have, I think, almost unanimous agreement among Lutheran commentators as to the significance of chapter 17. Chapter 17 is a description of the great Antichrist, especially the ecclesiastical Antichrist. And Antichrist in the book of Revelation has two sides to it. You have Antichrist, which is simply the great enemy of Christ. And now you have there the civil Antichrist, which is the beast from the sea, and then the what we call the ecclesiastical Antichrist. Which is the beast from the earth. This is civil government, then, in its anti-Christian aspect, and the church in its anti-Christian aspect. Now, in chapter 17, you've got them both. You have the great prostitute, dressed in scarlet, who sits on the beast that has the seven heads and the seven horns. The seven heads and the ten horns, rather. Now, that beast with the seven heads and the ten horns is that beast from the earth. The beast from the sea, rather. The beast from the earth is here described as a woman, a prostitute, a harlot, sitting on top of this scarlet beast. So the two are really joined together in the same picture. Antichristian elements in the church and the antichristian elements in government have now joined forces. Actually, the anti-Christian element in the church sits on the anti-Christian government. Now, they turn against each other before the story is over with, before the vision is over with, but here at the beginning of the vision, you see them together. Now, one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came. Now, one other thing I wanted to say, and I just forgot it now. Now, in the ecclesiastical Antichrist, the greatest manifestation of that is in the papacy. The papacy of Rome. In Luther's day, it was the Pope and the Turk. Some of you still remember the original wording of that Reformation hymn, which says, "Destroy those who feign by craft and sword would wrest the kingdom from thy son." Now, the original wording of that, as Luther wrote it, now translated into English, was, "Destroy the murderous Pope and Turk." Now, our modern version of that hymn does not have that anymore, "Destroy the murderous Pope and Turk," because the Pope was the great murderer of Christians in the Reformation times, who was trying to wipe out the orthodox teachers, the ones who preached salvation by grace, by killing them off. See, a lot of Lutherans were put to death for their faith during that time. A lot of Protestants died for their faith, not only in persecutions, but in wars that were fought in order to destroy the Protestant church, to destroy the Lutheran church, really. And those wars were fought, first of all, by the Roman Catholic authorities. So that Charles V the Emperor of Spain, the King of Spain and Emperor of Germany, was the great Catholic ruler who did everything in his power to destroy the Lutheran Church. And of course, sitting on Charles V was the Pope, who was riding him as his horse, his battle horse. The Pope was using the Emperor to fight against the Church. In fact, the Pope called upon the Emperor again and again to destroy the Lutherans, to enforce the Edict of Worms. See, the Edict of Worms said that Luther was to be killed and all of his followers were to be destroyed finally. Now, that was the aim of both the Church and the state of that time. And then the Turks came in from the east attacking Christianity, and they were the civil Antichrist, really, in its purity. So you have all these elements coming together, fighting against God's people, against those who believe not in the message of the dragon, the message of salvation by works, but who believe in the message of salvation by grace alone, who believe in the gospel. All right, now one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came and said to me, "Come, I will show you the punishment of the great prostitutes who sits on many waters. With her, the kings of the earth committed adultery, and the inhabitants of the earth were intoxicated with the wine of her adulteries. Then the angel carried me away in the spirit into a desert. There I saw a woman." Now, this is something now, what I'm going to say now is not something on which all Lutherans are agreed. But I am convinced again in my mind that this is a correct interpretation. If somebody has a different interpretation, I think that we can live with that as long as it doesn't bring any kind of false doctrine into the church. But you remember in chapter 11, we read about a woman who went into the desert. Right? She was given wings as of an eagle, and she fled into the desert where she was nourished for 1260 days, for 42 months, for 3.5 years, which is the time of the Gentiles, which is defined then as the time during which the Gentiles walk in the holy city and live in the holy city, the time during which unbelievers are in the church. And we know from other passages of the Bible, as I said last time, that must be the time of the New Testament, because the Bible tells us very clearly that the unbelievers are not going to be separated from the church until what day? Until the harvest day, see? The tares are going to grow till harvest. And the bad fish are going to be in the net until it's pulled up on shore. And we are told in that whole context that that's going to happen on the day of judgment. All right, so the time of the Gentiles, the 3.5 years, or the 42 months, or the 1260 days, must be a symbolic way of representing that period of the Gentiles, during which the church is going to be made up, the visible church is going to be made up of believers and unbelievers. See, the church in heaven will also be a visible church, but there it will be made up of only believers. Here the net is still underwater, the tares are still growing in the field. Now, the woman in chapter 12 is the church. Now, John goes into the desert and he sees a woman in the desert. And she is a great prostitute. Now, that symbolism is familiar from the Old Testament. Because in the Old Testament, again and again, the people of God are called the bride of Jehovah, the wife of Jehovah. The children of Israel are God's bride. In the New Testament, you have the same figure of speech. Husbands, love your wives, even as Christ loved the church and gave himself for it. And so the relationship between Christ and his church there is compared to the relationship between a husband and his wife. In chapter 19, you read that for tonight, the day of judgment, the day when God's people are going to be in heaven, is called the marriage of the Lamb, when his bride has made herself ready. He's come to take his bride home. You know the parable of the 10 virgins, where the church is compared to a bride waiting for the bridegroom to come. So that you have that all the way through the Bible. The church is compared to the wife of Jehovah in the Old Testament, the bride of Christ in the New Testament. And because of that, whenever the church goes astray, When the church begins to worship false gods, so often in the Old Testament, the church is not accused of idolatry, but God says that his people are guilty of adultery. And that's kind of remarkable, isn't it? They worship idols, and then God says, you're guilty of adultery. Well, where does that come from? Well, from that picture of the Old Testament church being the wife of Jehovah. Now, when the wife of Jehovah goes and worships idols, then obviously she is guilty of adultery. She has become a prostitute. In the book of Hosea, in the Old Testament, Hosea is commanded to marry a prostitute. And Hosea's marriage then is used by God as a symbol for the relationship between himself and the children of Israel. The children of Israel have become a prostitute. In Isaiah, you have the statement, how has the holy city become a harlot? The holy city, of course, is Jerusalem. Jerusalem was the city of God, the holy place of the tabernacle of the Most High, in Psalm 46. And the holy city has become a prostitute. So the idea of the church becoming unfaithful and being called a prostitute is a very familiar one from the Bible, especially the Old Testament. And now here it says that John was taken into the desert, and there he saw a woman, but the woman now is a prostitute. And I think there's a connection between those two. There certainly is a connection between these various symbols. We had in chapter 16, you remember, we had the dragon, the beast, and the false prophet. That's in the vision of the seven bowls, but those same symbols are used in the series of seven visions that you have in chapters 12 and 13. And so here too, we go back once more to chapter 12, and we see a woman in the desert, only now this woman is clothed in scarlet. In chapter 12, she was clothed with the sun. In chapter 12, her glory is a heavenly glory. In chapter 17, her glory has become earthly glory. Huh? She's clothed in scarlet and gold and precious stones and pearls. She glitters with all kinds of splendor. But she's unfaithful to the Lord. She is no longer God's wife, but she has become a prostitute, as Jerusalem in the Old Testament had become unfaithful. And so they were intoxicated with the wine of her adulteries. Now, adultery is unfaithfulness to a husband or wife. It's unfaithfulness in the marriage relationship. That's why Thou Shalt Not Commit Adultery by Luther is translated with the German words, Du sollst nicht ehebrechen. You shall not break up a marriage. That's the specific meaning of the word adultery. Fornication is... Fornication can be committed by unmarried people, but adultery is committed by married people. And so this woman is guilty of adultery. She's been married once before, see? And now she has become a prostitute, which also fits in with the picture of the church having become unfaithful. And she has a great deal of worldly splendor now, but she's lost her heavenly glory. And she sits on the scarlet beast. And now she held a golden cup in her hand, filled with abominable things and the filth of her adulteries. This title was written on her forehead. By the way, this was customary in the time of John, that harlots wrote their name on a plate on their foreheads. That was the way they advertised. And so this woman also, like a harlot, wears such a sign on her forehead with her name engraved on it. And the name is this, Mystery. Babylon the Great, the mother of prostitutes and the abominations of the earth. Kind of interesting here that in 2 Thessalonians 2:7, where Paul talks about the Antichrist, the coming of the Antichrist, the man of sin, he calls the Antichrist the mystery of iniquity. That's a name for this great enemy of the church who's going to come before the end of the world and who is already active in Paul's day. Paul says the mystery of iniquity is already at work, and someday it's going to become open so that everybody can recognize it for what it is. At least God's people can recognize it for what it is. And that Antichrist there is called, the ecclesiastical Antichrist there is called the mystery of iniquity. And here this woman has the name Mystery. Babylon the Great, Babylon was the great enemy of God's people in the Old Testament. The figures of the book of Revelation are Old Testament figures for the most part. And the Babylon, you're all familiar with the Babylonian captivity. See, Babylon destroyed the city of Jerusalem. Babylon led the people of God into exile and put an end, really, to the Jewish kingdom. And so the great destroyer of God's people in the Old Testament was Babylon. Egypt and Babylon are the two great enemies. Egypt, where the children of Israel were in captivity for 400 years, and Babylon then, where the children of Israel were led into captivity for 70 years. And so this is the great enemy of the church then, the mother of prostitutes and of the abominations of the earth. I saw that the woman was drunk with the blood of saints, the blood of those who bore testimony to Jesus. She was killing believers now, which is exactly what the Roman Catholic Church has done. The Roman Catholic Church through the ages has destroyed many, many Christians, in actuality, killed them for their faith. One of our hymns in the hymnal, for example, is written to celebrate the death of one of those first Lutheran confessors. Upon the waters cast, I forget what the first line is, upon the waters cast, the martyr's ashes watch shall gathered be at last. It's one of the Reformation hymns, which we have in our hymnal. That hymn Luther wrote because of the burning of some Lutheran monks, some monks who had become Lutheran in their faith and who were burned to death for their faith. William Tyndale, one of the first translators of the Bible into English, a student of Luther's at Wittenberg, was burned at the stake. And so in France during the time of the Huguenots, thousands upon people were slaughtered in one night in the St. Bartholomew's massacre, and all at the instigation of the Roman Catholic Church. And so here that the Antichrist, the ecclesiastical Antichrist, is pictured as a persecutor of God's people. In Roman Catholic countries, even to this day, very often people are persecuted because of their faith and killed because of their faith. In South America, for example, within our lifetime, Christians have been killed in South America because they were not Roman Catholic, because they were Protestants.